Let's get to James. James, how are you today?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much for having me on, as always.
Well, as always, we enjoy having you. Basically, things seem to be going on. We notice that the economy over in China is beginning to contract. We notice the contrary to everything. They're having real troubles over in Europe, and even Germany is actually having some financial troubles. We're looking at certainly 27% unemployment in Greece and Italy and those countries over there, 60 or 70% among the young people. Basically, the economy of Europe is in trouble, but even here in America, where they keep trying to tell us that things are getting better and that the unemployment rate is dropping, but we have more people who are not working. How can the unemployment rate be dropping and more people aren't working? Well, it's very, very simple. They simply don't count you if you're not looking for a job. And so many people have given up looking for jobs because they just aren't there or it's unqualified for them. James, we want to get your view of what's going on in America and throughout the world today.
Well, unfortunately, as you indicate, it's not a very pretty picture. And as you say, for example, in the Eurozone, they're dealing with the sixth straight quarter of recession in the 17-nation Eurozone. And it's pretty bad over there. As you say, not only the unemployment figures, but of course the falling productivity, and even places like Spain, which are being particularly troublesome these days, are having problems with things such as a trade surplus, which you would normally expect would be a good thing and a sign of a productive economy. But in fact, in Spain, it's actually a sign that basically they're not importing enough because there's no domestic demand. So basically everything that could possibly be going wrong seems to be going wrong. And because of a lot of the problems that are happening in Europe, in Asia, in other places, the American dollar is going up and up and up and is doing quite well these days compared to other currencies. But even that in and of itself can be a bad thing in this topsy-turvy time, because everyone wants to race their currency to the bottom, and America seems to be losing in that regard. So there's a lot of strange things going on right now.
Well, apparently Japan is certainly massively increasing their currency in circulation and intensely trying to drop the value of their currency, which in effect simply steals the life savings of the people in Japan who've invested, just think they'll have money when they retire. And basically, if they double the money supply, they'll almost, they cut back tremendously on the value of the cash holdings of those people, won't they?
That's exactly right, and that's exactly what's happening now. The yen's devalued 25% in the last 6 months.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is James Corbett, and James has taken over Bob Chapman's place at the International Forecaster, and you can get his writings every week, or actually bi-weekly now, by subscribing to the International Forecaster. But certainly James is giving us a commentary on what's going on throughout the world, what's going on certainly as far as Europe is concerned, where the economy over there is contracting. Certainly in Japan, of course, they're actually trying to stimulate the economy by doubling the amount of money in circulation. But down the line, this is going to have a disastrous effect on the value of the Japanese currency. And James was just saying that actually the value of Japanese currency has declined 25%. How long did it take that? And what's going to happen to those people who worked their whole life amassing funds for retirement, and you steal 25% of what they've saved? Are the Japanese people upset at this thought?
Well, so far, I think there may be some smokescreen to what's really going on, because the Nikkei, the Japanese stock index, has been going through the roof, and that has gained something like something in the range of 60% over that same six-month period that the yen has dropped 25%. So there is very much similar to the American situation, where the S&P is hitting new highs seemingly every week. The Nikkei is hitting new highs, and everyone seems to be quite pleased about that. And in fact, the first quarter of GDP results here in Japan showed a 0.9% growth, which is 3.5% annualized. That's quite a significant growth rate for a country that's been mired in this stagflation for for a very, or sorry, the type of deflationary stagnant economy for two decades now. So everyone's quite happy about this so far, and it seems that Abenomics, as it's being called after the new prime minister here, Shinzo Abe, is working. It's stimulating the economy in the way that they wanted. But as you say, this is, of course, eating into the long-term savings of the Japanese, many of whom are invested in Japanese government bonds for their long-term savings. And the Japanese government bond markets are, again, showing signs that they're completely out of control. In fact, trading was halted twice last week on Japanese government bond futures because the markets were just plummeting, yields absolutely just bottom falling out. Which shows that the plan is not exactly working the way that they're saying it is. Of course, if the government loses control of the bonds, then basically the entire scheme is worthless, because once you get to the point where people aren't buying Japanese government bonds anymore, and they can't fuel and fund that 200% plus debt to GDP ratio, the bottom will fall out.
Well, this is Dr. Stan and Jane simply saying that over in Japan, why, things really look pretty good. The stock market's going up. Yes, the currency's lost 25% of its value, but the stock market has gone up 60%. And people look at that and say, isn't that wonderful? I've got some of my money in the stock market. And it's getting more and more in the way of value. But one of the big problems over there is that the bond market is dropping because interest rates are beginning to go up. When interest rates go up, the bond market begins to drop. And eventually, of course, when people don't want to buy bonds anymore, then, of course, what's going to happen is that certainly, how will Japan fund its debt? Its debt is over, 2.5 times your gross domestic product.
Yes, it is in that range. It's the highest in the entire industrialized world, and it is worrying because, of course, this has been propped up before, up until this point, by the Japanese population themselves, who buy the Japanese government bonds. But as more and more of the population here is retiring, that's going to start tapering off just as a function of demographics. And then add on top of that the volatility in the Japanese government bond market, and it starts to become a less attractive investment. And the real danger here is that the Japanese banking sector has been absolutely just teetering on the edge of complete collapse for decades, and has been only propped up by a lot of intervention through government action. And the entire banking sector is also heavily invested in Japanese government bonds, and quite prone to problems in that market. So we could, it's certainly a possibility that the collapse in Japan would be started by some sort of Japanese banking crisis as a result of the Japanese government bond market volatility. And that's a very realistic possibility for what we see coming, especially if they're not able to contain the effects of all of this yen printing that they're doing at the moment. And they have committed to double the monetary supply of Japan in the next 2 years, so that's a pretty significant increase, and it looks like they're already starting to lose control, and it's only been a couple of months.
And basically, what you're seeing is this effort on the part of men to try to manipulate the economy. And rather than have a free economy, they say, no, these people are smart enough, they can manipulate the economy, and we can have wonderful prosperity, we can provide for the elderly. And the system worked very well in Japan. It's worked very well here in America. The only trouble is there's the graying of the society of Japan. Their reproduction rate is low, about 1.2 children per family. And because more and more people are growing old and retiring, and of course, basically, who's going to support them? There's not another generation coming along to support the elderly generation, and that is what's happening in America today. Basically, of course, so we have about 57 million people retired. Another 78 million people will retire in the next 20 years. And basically, where are we going to get the people to fund them, to support them? And we're going to have a very hard time. This is one reason why they're so anxious to have all the illegal immigrants become legal, so that they will feed into the economic system, because they know very well that the whole system is on the verge of collapse. And if you read what the elite say, even in something like Time magazine, Richard Haass writing in Time magazine on the 12th of May of this year on page 10 basically said that basically the current economic system is not sustainable. It's not a matter of if, but when the whole system in the United States comes down. And this is what they're facing in Japan and Europe, all over throughout the world. Would you agree or disagree with that?
Well, I agree. And I think you hit upon one of the important factors in all of this, which is the central banking aspect and nature of this. The fact that the economy is so widely controlled by such a narrow segment of the economy, namely the central bank, which gets to control the issuance of money and how it flows through the system. And of course, setting the interest rates, which is extremely important for basically determining the rise, the ebb and flow of the economy. And it's important for people to, again, to reflect on the fact that it has not always been this way. There have not always been national central banks that have directed the economies of their countries. And of course, in the United States specifically, for much of the nation's history, there was no national central bank. And it's important to understand when and why and how that all came together. And I believe last week we talked about that we would maybe hit on the Federal Reserve and how that really developed in the United States and why that's important. So perhaps we should talk a little bit about the history of the Federal Reserve.
Well, then why don't we do that? Because it's vitally important people understand that this is a privately owned central bank. A group of people who think that they could do a better job than God can, or that there's simply the some efforts of all the people who maintain the economy, know they're going to have a little elite group who is going to certainly regulate the economy for the welfare of the public. And if you believe that, ladies and gentlemen, you're incredibly naive. They are regulating the economy for the benefit of the people who are getting, you know, bonuses of $20, $30, $40, $50 billion a year, who run our banks. And this is the way the system really works. And behind them, of course, are the stockholders who run the tremendous amounts of stock. And then the six major corporations, banking corporations, that control 69% of all the financial assets in America, and certainly make mockery of the idea that we have a free society. But you go right ahead. Let's get into the background of the Federal Reserve. I think it's vitally important people understand who controls our central bank, and it certainly isn't Congress. Go right ahead.
Well, you're exactly right about that. Congress, quite the opposite, is controlled by the money interest, which controls the central bank. But to understand the history of central banking in the United States, you need to go back to the founding of the country, when the big debate at the time was between people like Alexander Hamilton and people like Thomas Jefferson, and they were arguing about the way that the national economy should be structured in the United States. And Alexander Hamilton ultimately ended up winning that debate because he was appointed the first Treasury Secretary and instituted the first Bank of the United States, a central bank. And it was part of his idea, which became known as the American School of Economics, that national debt was in fact a good thing. It helped to establish the credit of the country and helped to establish the fact that the central government could direct some of the resources of the people into building up the country. And he thought it was very important that America did that. So you had the first Bank of the United States, which I believe ran on a 20-year charter, which was eventually allowed to expire. And then in 1817, the second Bank of the United States came along, again for a 20-year charter, which again was allowed to expire, or was under much great protest from the bankers, of course. But Andrew Jackson ended up defeating the second Bank of the United States, and it went into liquidation in 1841. And at the end of his life, Alexander Hamilton is famously said to have remarked that his greatest accomplishment was that I killed the bank. So it was not some small victory for him. It was something that was quite important to him throughout all of his different battles that he won throughout his life. The fact that he got rid of the Second Bank of the United States and returned America to really a hard money, laissez-faire, free market system, which remained dominant for 80 years from the death of the Second Bank of the United States until 1913. There was no central bank in the United States, and it operated along principles that were quite laissez-faire, quite free market. And basically, a lot of different banks issued their own notes, and those notes competed on the open market. And this was basically the basis for the incredible industrial productivity of the United States in the 19th century. And it was quite a remarkably effective system for a long time. But by the end of the 19th century, you started to have a lot of advocates for reform and different types of reformist movements coming along, to the point where by 1896, you had the Democrat Party, which had hitherto been the hard money, laissez-faire, free market type party, was taken over by people like William Jennings Bryan, who was an anti-gold, free silver advocate. And as a result, the population shifted over to the Republican Party, which became the hard money party under McKinley, who was basically a protege of Morgan and the banking interests and Rockefeller. So there was a lot of backstage types of things that were taking place at that time. And one of the interesting things to come out of that was something called the Indianapolis Monetary Convention of 1896, which brought together supposedly a bunch of Midwestern salt of the earth type businessmen to talk about the subject of monetary reform and how how things like the banking panic of 1893 could be averted by, well, perhaps bringing in some sort of central bank type system. And so this Indianapolis convention in 1896 brought together what was supposed to be a bunch of business leaders from the Midwest, but ended up, when you actually look at the people who formed its executive committee, being basically a bunch of people tied into Kuhn, Loeb, Morgan, Rockefeller interests, basically the money interests, had the control of this convention, which eventually came out advocating for a type of national banking system. And that over the subsequent years was an idea that was floated through the business and political communities until 1907, where there was another banking crisis, which really panicked people to a large extent, because in this banking crisis, the New York Stock Exchange, for example, fell almost 50% in 1 year, and it was seen as quite a disastrous thing. And so people who were quite concerned about this and the volatility in the system were looking for a way out of it. And lo and behold, the bankers, the Wall Street bankers, were happy to provide their solution, which was the idea for a unified central bank. So back in 1910, you had the hoi polloi, the hoity-toity, I should say, of the Wall Street banking world meeting together on Jekyll Island for just off the coast of Georgia for a secretive meeting of people like Frank Vanderlip and Harry P. Davison and A. P. Pyatt Andrew and just basically the absolute elite of the banking world. And they met in utter secrecy on Jekyll Island for about 10 days and came out with a plan that eventually became basically the basis for the Federal Reserve Act, which was implemented 3 years later in December of 1913, which is almost exactly 100 years ago today.
100 years ago, they laid out a plan so that a small number of people would be able to control the monetary system and ultimately control the nation. Ladies and gentlemen, that's where we are today. And if you really think that the congressmen are allowed to vote independently, of course, after the 9/11 attack, they voted down the Patriot Act. And then, of course, in violation of their own rules, well, they brought it right back within a week after putting out, I think, $10-15 billion to buy the votes of about 25 congressmen. When you can make money out of nothing, you can do whatever you want. Well, James, you go right ahead.
Well, you said it well right there. When you make the money, you can do whatever you want. And of course, that was the real basis for establishing the Federal Reserve from the very beginning. The question for the banking community was, well, if we have this gold standard system, how can we achieve this type of system that we want, where basically we get to control the money supply? So that was the big call for reform that came out of the Indianapolis Convention in 1896, and which continued forward until the establishment of the Federal Reserve. There needed to be elasticity in the banking sector to basically provide credit during times of tightening. And so this became the rallying cry for the banking reform advocates. And eventually they did get their way in 1913 after the Aldrich Plan was released to the public, as it was called, named after Aldrich, the powerful U.S. senator who was heavily tied into the banking sector. And that was seen by the public as being closely tied into the money interest, and everyone understood it for what it was. So the Federal Reserve Act was a type of smokescreen, which basically advocated for the exact same type of system, but was seen to be coming from neutral sources. And so the public was duped into believing that this was not just another part of the money interest's plan. The Federal Reserve Act, even so, was still barely passed on December 23rd of 1913, during a time of a lot of the senators believed that the Senate was in recess, but in fact they had not called the special type of recess that allows the Senate to basically stop all legislation from being passed during that time. So in fact, there were very few people on the floor during the passage of the Federal Reserve Act there in December of 1913. And lo and behold, suddenly there's a national central bank once again in the United States. So from 1913 until the present 100 years, the Federal Reserve has basically been overseeing the money supply of the United States. And as people, I think, are becoming more and more aware, of course, the Federal Reserve, there is nothing federal about it in the sense that it is not a government entity or agency. It is a privately owned banking system with regional banks, and the shareholders of those regional banks are all private banks, and they receive dividends for their shares, for their stocks. So it is a privately owned system that has the privilege of maintaining the money supply. And basically this is done by issuing Federal Reserve notes to the U.S. Treasury indirectly through purchase of U.S. government bonds on the open market. And this is a system by which supposedly everything is maintained in a nice healthy balance. But of course, the Federal Reserve was brought in to basically stop the types of banking panics that had panicked people so much. For example, 1893, 1907, these types of major panics had occurred, and the Federal Reserve was supposedly going to stop all of that. But somehow or other, the Great Depression came along, and on the Federal Reserve's watch. And in fact, much later, Ben Bernanke, the current chairman of the Federal Reserve, admitted, yes, in fact, the Federal Reserve did cause the Great Depression, but we won't do it again, he said, half jokingly. So basically, the entire raison d'être for the creation of the Federal Reserve was nullified by the fact that it created its own banking crises and panics. And I think we all understand that all of the volatility and all of the things that happen in our current modern day economy are at least indirectly the result of the actions of the Federal Reserve and its manipulations in the free market. We do not have a free market and have not for, well, at the very least 100 years, to the extent that it even existed before that.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Sidney James is pointing out that we really have not had a free market for the last 100 years. That is simply the Federal Reserve System, that privately owned central bank, has controlled our economy. And initially, of course, they weren't that active. Certainly right after the initial takeover of our banking system in 1913, not too much happened. Suddenly we were in World War One, and they needed suddenly the central bank to be able to create money so that we could finance our war effort. And following the war, then we had a recession in the early 1920s. Then we had a boom, the Roaring Twenties. And then, of course, at the end of 1929, why they contracted the money supply and they created the Great Recession. And we didn't get out of that recession really for, well, 11, 12 years until we actually got involved in 1941 in World War II. And then, of course, the system has gone along since then. Sometimes we've had recessions and contractions and expansions. When they created the Federal Reserve System, the central bank, so we wouldn't have the expansions and contractions, but they've occurred exactly the same. But now, of course, we've sort of reached the end of our cycle. And basically, we can look and see the massive debt that we have, and that you do not have a debt of $16.7 trillion, as you're told. If you look at the real debt, they're simply lying to us what it's about. It's really somewhere between $50 and $80 trillion. It can never be repaid. Basically, of course, the only reason we're not collapsing into Sydney chaos at the present time is between the year 2000 and the present. They've increased the amount of money in circulation from $500 billion to about $3.2 trillion. They've increased it about six times in 13 years. And this is a recipe for disaster, because sooner or later, this whole financial system is going to go kaput, and the majority of the American people are going to lose everything that they certainly have worked their whole lives for. Their pension funds. Many of them, of course, invested in bonds, and those bonds, one of these days, when interest rates go up, will become worthless. What's your take on what's going to happen next now, James?
Well, unfortunately, what's happening now and what's going to happen next are very much directed by a type of corrupt economic philosophy that has been floating around for at least the last 50 years, and which I think finds its antecedents in people like Alexander Hamilton, and that's Keynesian economics. And Keynes was basically a high-ranking member of the inner elite circles of the banking and political worlds, who also happened to be a rabid eugenicist, who I believe was married into the Darwin-Galton Wedgwood family line, which is the founding family line of the eugenics movement, which of course sees that there's a tiny elite that just the very basis of their genetics make them natural rulers of the world. So Keynes was heavily connected with that, and I believe for a time was even president of the American Eugenics Society, or in some ways quite closely affiliated to it. Anyway, he came out with an economic philosophy that basically said that government spending and debt was a great thing, and it was what should be used to drive the economy forward and to expand the nation's economy. And this has been taken to heart and very much is determining what's happening at the present time. So we have Keynesians like Paul Krugman over at the New York Times winning the Nobel Prize and getting to use that soapbox to basically spread this philosophy even further and to argue, no, we shouldn't be concerned about the debt levels. We should be even trying to spend more money. We should be bringing in more massive government programs. And because of this, I think that's exactly the direction that we're heading. The conversation right now, as people probably know by now, is not whether or not we should be in debt, whether or not we should be trying to get out of debt, or how we should be trying to get out of the debt. The question is really, well, how much debt should we have, and how quickly should it expand? Should we do a lot of debt quickly, or should we ease off on the gas pedal? And that seems to be the only debate that's happening in Washington right now. And of course, that debate has been engineered to be that way, because who does it benefit for the government to go into debt and to spend money on these types of projects? Of course, the people who benefit from this type of money, this hot money from the government, are the people who receive it first. Those people receive the full value of that money, and then as that money starts to circulate in the economy, it becomes devalued through inflation. So people who are closely politically connected and people who are benefiting from these types of funds obviously have a vested interest in maintaining this spending of the government. So unfortunately, because of this type of capture of the government by the money interests, I don't think we're going to see a real putting on of the brake anytime soon. The most I think that we're going to get is an easing off on the gas pedal, but ultimately we are still heading towards the economic cliff, and there's no way to avoid it unless someone takes the control of the steering wheel and starts basically wrenching it around and steering the country in another direction.
Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And I will tell you, for the last 3 weeks, there have been articles by members of the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission in Time magazine that sounds just like James Corbett. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly I was just commenting that I think that there's some people in the elite who suddenly really don't know what to do. They recognize that we're headed for disaster. There's no way you can keep piling on debt on top of debt on top of debt. There's no way you can continue printing money upon more money and more money without eventually having serious financial problems. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, as I say, I think that this is part of this fundamental philosophic corruption that's taken place. This idea that governments should exist to basically be debt providers, and that they should just create debt in order to move the economy forward. And until that underlying philosophy is dealt with, and I would argue from a Misesian perspective, it's not going to go away politically anytime soon. And of course, that, as I say, is because there is a vested interest in keeping the system going as it is, because it's profiting quite handsomely to those at the very top, as we've seen through the ridiculous bailouts of recent years and the literally trillions upon trillions of dollars that have been shunted off into the banking sector via the Federal Reserve System, which has on its board many of the people in the banking sector who profited from the bailouts. So it is a system that has been self-evidently set up for the interests of the very few and at the expense of the very, very many. And I think we can basically ultimately indicate that there's a lot of the ills of the world are taking place because of this system, specifically in the United States, and systems like it that have been set up in virtually every country of the globe.
Well, I think that everything is in place for a major disaster. It's not a matter, in my mind, of if, but when. And those are actually the words of Richard Haass, member, president of the Council on Foreign Relations, certainly member of the Trilateral Commission, and writing on the 12th of May in Time magazine, I think on page 10, he basically says, the way things are going, it's not a matter of if we're going to have a financial catastrophe, but when it's going to occur. And when we see people of that caliber, the brains is close to the very power pinnacle here in the United States expressing concern, I think that we should all be concerned, begin making our preparations accordingly, because I can assure you that the people who run our country are making preparations to protect themselves and their families. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess is James Corbett, and we have actually three callers on the line. We're going to get to them all in just a moment. But before we go on, James, would you like to tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you, how they can subscribe to the International Forecaster, and how they can actually get your material from your financial advisory letter, financial consulting letter, put it that way.
All right, excellent. Well, of course, if people are interested in the International Forecaster, the best place to go for information about it is theinternationalforecaster.com. That's all one word, theinternationalforecaster.com. And there you can find sample articles. You can also subscribe, or you can even get a free introductory copy if you want to see what the forecaster looks like before you subscribe. And basically, it comes out twice a week. It's somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 to 50 pages each edition, and contains all sorts of information on what's happening in the markets, but also social geopolitical issues. It is just jam-packed with information. So once again, people can go to theinternationalforecaster.com, or if you want to use snail mail, you can write to P.O. Box 7752, Winter Haven, Florida, 33883. That's P.O. Box 7752, Winter Haven, Florida, 33883. And if you're interested in my own work, I'm at CorbettReport.com. That's C-O-R-B-E-T-T report.com. And in fact, I'm just about to release a new DVD that will be a compilation of basically every single podcast, interview, article, video, every single piece of media that I released in the year 2010 on a two-disc data DVD set. So basically DVDs that would play in your PC or your Mac. And contains almost 15 gigabytes of information, so literally hundreds and hundreds of hours of media on these discs. So there will be more information on that at CorbettReport.com starting tomorrow.
Okay, fine. Well, let's go to Ronald, who's calling us from Monterey. Hi, Ronald. Do you have a question or comment for our guest?
Hello, Dr. Stan. First of all, I'm going to get a little poetic on it here. You know the old Fred Astaire song, "There may be trouble ahead, blah, blah, blah. Let's face the music and dance."
Okay.
So I say, you know, everything from the world blowing up and all of us turning into atoms can happen to nothing happen. So I think when people like Richard Haass come in, I don't trust him at all. I think he's CIA. I think if we don't worry, first of all, we can keep from worrying. And if we can keep ourselves living and trying to be happy and trying to let good take over to start. And then on the other hand, I think it's impossible for the United States government to go bankrupt, because who could ever foreclose on the United States? And what would they do? They can't take the Yellowstone National Park.
Have you ever seen the DVD, pardon me, the program up on the internet? It's called Revolution. I'd suggest you watch it. It's Monday evening, and it basically tells you what can happen to America, and I think it very well will. It's called Revolution, Monday evening, NBC. Hope you look at it, Ronald, and let's go to John calling from Spokane. John, did you have a question or comment?
I've got a question and then a follow-up question to the answer, whatever it is. I was of the understanding that the Fed charter expired December 2012. Now, is that true?
That is not true.
Okay, when does it expire?
It does not expire. There is a clause in the Federal Reserve Act that means that it will continue until such time as Congress discontinues it. So there is no expiry on the charter.
Okay, well, that was circulating. I don't know where that came from.
Well, I'll tell you what, John, there's a lot of information out there that they put out just to confuse you. So basically, you have to check and double-check and triple-check. Remember, I said there's a lot of wonderful information on the Internet, but the other side is putting out all sorts of disinformation to confuse us. Go right ahead.
Well, that's mainly my question. I'll let you move on to the next caller.
Okay, fine. Thanks very much.
Okay, and let me just add for other people with that question. Once again, that question is answered on the Federal Reserve website, federalreserve.gov, under the FAQ section. And it says that the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 has been amended or altered by the Congress numerous times over the year, but the Act has never included an expiration date or repeal date. As stated in the law itself, the Federal Reserve Act can only be repealed, amended, or altered by the Congress. So it will not go away on its own, and it will not be allowed to expire. It has to be actually killed, I suppose, by the Congress.
Okay, very good. Well, let's go to Jim, who's calling us from Georgia. Hi, Jim. How are you going? I have a question or comment for our guest.
Sir, I'm doing all well, all things considered. Wonderful to speak to two brilliant minds and spirits. I love you both dearly. And because in my quest for truth, both of you have helped me. So, I will say this on your last caller. Don't you find it odd, too, that all these things are converging at that about 100-year mark? Regardless, you know, what I understand is they really did have a charter, but it was, they reviewed it and they revised and said that there wouldn't be a 100-year. That's fine. You know, but don't you find it odd? And, also, these people who plan to and have been, I see it from local government all the way up to top. They look like spoiled children, no matter what color hair they have, no matter how many wrinkles they have, they look like spoiled children.
Okay, fine, Jim. Well, thank you very much for calling, and let's go to Dave is calling us from Big Sur. I get our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. It really doesn't matter what the people who hold the reins of power look like. It's what they're doing with their power that is going to have an impact on our lives. Dave calling from Big Sur. Go right ahead, Dave.
Hi, Dr. Stan. I think with respect to December 12th, previous caller, there was something I read about the Federal Reserve running out of treasury bills to sell in order to raise the money to buy all these asset-backed mortgage bonds. And I don't know if that's true or not. And that would be the official date that they started printing money or something. The other thing I just wanted to say, I've been following the stock market for so many decades. And for the past couple years, I've been quite bearish. And, you know, every time I think it's about ready to tumble, I'm wrong. But I do feel that we've reached a point, at least according to the Elliott Wave theory, and also the fact that the market closed at 1666 today is kind of an ominous sign. I just wanted to make those two comments.
Well, if I could say, Dave, I think that the market will continue going up as long as the Federal Reserve continues pouring money into the system at the rate of $85 billion a month, which they're creating out of nothing. They keep hinting that maybe they're going to stop, but of course they haven't done it. And when it becomes obvious that they're going to stop pouring money into the system, why, the whole thing, I think, is going to begin to crumble and fall apart. The only thing that's keeping us going today is massive infusion of money into the system. If that stops, why hang on to your hat? Well, how would you respond to that, James?
Well, I agree completely. I think that this is a system that's self-evidently being propped up by the injections of money into the economy and basically the promise of never-ending quantitative easing. And we have heard in recent weeks more and more talk and kind of rumors being floated and circulated, even by the president of the San Francisco Federal Reserve Bank, that there will be an end to easing even as early as the end of this year. But I really see that as part of a strategy of basically assuring the markets that there will be at some point there will be a way out of this quantitative easing, but I really don't see a way out of it. I think they've painted themselves into a corner where basically if they aren't pumping this money into the economy, the bottom will fall out of that market. And I think you're right, as long as they're continuing to pump that in and as long as people basically aren't holding them accountable for this expansion of the money supply, this rally in the stocks can continue taking place, even as the dollar it continues being devalued. It's just that it's being devalued more slowly than the yen and the euro and other such competitors, so it looks like it's a rising currency, but it isn't, and purchasing power continues to decrease. And of course, in the 100 years of the Federal Reserve reign, the dollar has lost something in the neighborhood of 96% of its value, so that should go and basically show what Federal Reserves and central banks are really all about at the end of the day.
And David, you cannot believe a word that they say. Watch what they do. They'll tell you one thing, they'll do another. But you will notice that they, I think, when the market is topped out, when, of course, they simply begin to cut back on their massive spending. Anything else you want to say before we let you go?
No, I appreciate your comments, gentlemen. Thank you very much. I won't be buying Bush in the morning.
Okay, fine. Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question or comment, why give us a call. But basically, I think that we're in for a difficult times, but they can keep it going as long as they keep pouring the money out, because eventually it will eventually lead to hyperinflation. We don't know when that's going to happen, but there's cycles out there. And you get into hyperinflation, then you get a collapse, and then you start in all over again. It's happened time and time again. Look and see what happened in France in the early 1700s. Look and see what happened in France in the 1790s. Look and see what happened in Germany, certainly in the 1920s. Look and see what happened certainly in Argentina just a few years ago. But James, go ahead and certainly, what is your suggestion? What should people be doing? Is there anything more they should know about the Federal Reserve System?
There's a lot that they should know about the Federal Reserve System, but I think as the callers have indicated, there is the concern about what's happening and what's going to happen, and that's a natural concern. But one of the callers raised the point that that we should be concentrating on some of the positive ways that we can affect the system and not to give into the fear of what may be coming. And I wholeheartedly agree with that. I think what we have at the moment, as we see the rising stock markets and the rosy figures about the economy, even though we know that they are manipulated and fudged and not based on reality, at any rate, it seems that what we have in this particular window of time is something like the reprieve of Nineveh. We've been granted this space for breathing room during this time when we know that there is a reckoning that's coming, but it isn't here yet. And during this time, I think, is the time that not only should we be attempting to spread the word about this and spread knowledge about what's really happening in the economy and who's really controlling it and for what real purpose, but also, of course, to prepare ourselves. And there are many, many, many ways to do that. But I think that all of those ways have to rely not on advocating for the government to step in and do this or do that, because of course we know that the government is and has been for generations, if not centuries, controlled by these money interests. I think what people have to do is start looking for the ways that they can come together on the local level and grassroots level, people you actually know and have looked in the eye and shaken their hands and interact with on a daily basis, how you can come together to try to create alternative systems that don't rely on these big overarching Federal Reserves or national banks or these types of systems. Anything that you can do at the local level to ensure your own local economy is the thing that will see you through if and when that crash does occur. And the best part about that is, even if we're completely off base and there's no crash ever going to occur and everything's just peachy keen, it still doesn't, it still benefits people directly to start building up those local economies. And again, there are many different ways to do that, but I think people should be starting to think about sourcing their food food locally instead of trying to buy through the industrial agricultural system that that operates through these giant supermarket mega chains that that basically produces food in factories somewhere on the other side of the country or even the other side of the world, and you don't know what's going into your food, or interacting and transacting in local currencies, local community currencies, for example, as ways of circumventing the Federal Reserve notes, which we know aren't really even worth the paper that they're printed on. Again, there are lots of different ways people can come together at the local level and start affecting real change, and I hope that people start looking into that, because I think ultimately that's exactly what we should be using this time of reprieve for, so that we can really create the system that we want as an alternative, and when they collapse the overarching system, it will not affect us as much.
And I really believe this is true. I believe that we will be stressing more local control. Certainly, if we want to get responsible people into our local governments, preferably a very responsible local sheriff who believes in the Constitution and will maintain law and order. As the whole thing begins to break down, we can move into a state of lawlessness. Now, if you're in a major city, I believe you're going to be in real problems. This is why I stress, if you have an opportunity to get an area away from the major cities, you'll be ever so much more protected, you and your family, and certainly begin making those preparations of how you'll be able to live. And certainly it's nice to have a group of people who agree with you and who will help you, certainly when times get bad. Well, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Here in the Central Coast of California, if you have a question or comment for our guest, James Corbett, as we begin looking and analyzing what is really going on behind the scenes today. Now, certainly, there are so many things that point that we're moving towards some sort of a climax, certainly. There's all sorts of problems over there with Syria. Russia is bringing their fleet in to protect Syria. We seem to be intent upon toppling the Syrian government. And so they were working through our surrogates, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Israel. And they're on the front lines, because now Assad is claiming that if there's another attack on Syria, he will simply attack Tel Aviv. I think we're certainly in basically having a real potential problem. So somebody from, so Jay Call from Skell, I wanted to know if we had some ideas on, let's see what the ideas on. Our local banks. Well, I really don't know too much about the local banks. I think that probably some of the local banks, like the County Bank and certainly the Comerica Bank, where we bank, are pretty responsible. But that would not be something that would affect people across the country. But I certainly would recommend the County Bank and Comerica Bank here in our area. And basically, what would you say, James, to people who call and ask, well, what about certainly, where should I have my money today? Should I have it certainly in one of the major banks? Should I have it in a smaller local bank? What do you think?
Well, I definitely would say that local smaller banks are better in terms of not supporting the overall banking system. I mean, certainly if you have your money in the big six banks, basically you're helping to fund the system that's part of the root of the problem. But of course, with local banks, with community banking and credit unions and the like, there's always the risk. Small banks can be, of course, they can be equally as corrupt as the big banks, or they could be teetering on the edge of insolvency. And there are all sorts of problems that can happen with that. So unfortunately, again, there's no one-size-fits-all solution to this. I think people have to do the due diligence at their local level to find out what state their local credit unions and banking community banks are in, and try to, you know, find out, as you would with anything else that you're putting your money in. You try to find out from other people who've worked with them or used them in the past. You try to find out as much about the bank as you can. And just like any other investment, I also say diversify. I think that would be true with your financial institutions. Probably best not to keep all of your eggs in one basket or all of your money in one financial institution. So that would be my overall idea. But of course, again, it depends so much on the local level and what's available in your local community. So I think people just need to do their homework.
Diversify. The three rules of investment. Excellent. Well, let's go to Nick, who's calling us from Kennewick, Washington. Nick, did you have a question for our guest?
Yes, Dr. Stan, I do. And I'll ask a question, then I'm going to hang up so I can listen to you on the radio.
Well, you better hang on, because, of course, the question, you won't hear it on the radio because they're playing commercials. So we'll ask your question, then hang on for the answer.
Okay. My question is, would it help if at a grassroots level we were to get people together and vote in a flat tax that would be paid on every dollar that was spent, rather than the tax system we have now, and then abolish the IRS and save money through the thousands and thousands of people that they have? That would be my question.
All right. What about the idea of a flat tax and certainly doing away with the IRS?
It's an appealing idea, and I understand how it could theoretically be implemented in a way that would reduce the bureaucracy and the control of the government at the current time. But unfortunately, I've seen in recent years a lot of the type of elite political caste that are in the bank's back pockets advocating for just that type of system. And I think what they're ultimately planning to do is try to bring in both that type of that flat tax, but also to keep the remains of the progressive tax system that they have right now. And I think that what they're looking for is some type of hybrid. So I think they might hijack some of the momentum behind the idea for a flat tax. But I think it's going to be a type of national sales tax that they're going to try to bring in. And that will be, unfortunately, just another foot in the door for government. I don't want to dissuade people from that type of idea, but I think that we have to think very carefully about how that's ultimately going to be implemented, because, again, just like so many other ideas that have the potential for good, it can be used against the populace if it's used in a way that they didn't intend.
And I think that the solution is to cut back on the size of government to where it should be according to our Constitution. We don't need an alternative means of taxation, because nothing is going to change. They're still going to be wasting money funding. Dictators throughout the world will still have a mighty military, and with our troops all over the world, what we need to do is simply restrict the power of the federal government, and then we wouldn't need anywhere near as much taxation, and do away with the Internal Revenue Service and fund the federal government with tariffs and certainly other things that they had, like we did before we had the income tax. We basically, with tariffs and certainly and other federal taxes, we did not need an income tax. So my suggestion would be that we're looking for the wrong solution. Let's restrict the power of government so that men can be free. But thanks very much for calling, Nick, and we'll be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's been James Corbett. James, anything else you want to say before we let you go?
I just want to thank you again for giving me the platform for being here week after week. And I want to basically tip my hat to all of the work that you're doing, not only at the present time, but you've been doing over the decades to try to raise awareness of this, because I know that's had such an incredible effect on so many people around the world. And I once again just want to acknowledge that and thank you for the platform.
God bless you, and thanks very much, James.